we're going to call the property tax division to order. I know we're a little short on members, but they are here and they are going to be coming. We are a little short on time. We've been asked to be done before 10:30. There's a caucus that some of the members need to attend, so we are going to be starting. And we're going to start today with Mr. Ouellette from the department. Just a short, quick overview on property tax trends. Mr. Ouellette and Mr. Folkman.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, I'm Gordon Folkman, Director of the Property Tax Division at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I thought I would just take a few minutes just to introduce Eric Ouellette to the committee. Eric is a new addition to the department, and he's our research director for property tax-related type of work. And we were lucky to bring him on board, and he's you probably know him from his work with the League of Minnesota Cities, brings a lot of experience in the property tax system. So we value his addition to the department to help us with our analytical support for our oversight functions and providing citizens and the legislature with good analytical information on the property tax system. So with that introduction, I'll turn it over to Eric. And the agenda for the first part of this discussion is Eric's going to run through some levy trend information, give you an overview of some valuation trends, but then we have some assessors as well in the audience, and they'll come before the committee and talk a little bit more about some specific things that are occurring at the ground level. So hopefully it'll be a fairly informative hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Folkman. Mr. Ouellette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Eric Ouellette with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. You have a handout. Members and staff have a color handout. The ones on the table are black and white, so it may not be quite as easy to read. I will go through this quickly to respect your time. If there's anything you want me to slow down on and go in more detail, just let me know. Let me start with the certified levies that were certified at the end of the year. Final 2008 property tax levies are up 7.3% from 2007. That's about $494 million higher than they were in 2007. This is a pretty big, about a $56 million reduction from where the preliminary September levies were. Prelims were in at 8.1% increase, and we ended up at 7.3%. That's a little bit bigger reduction than we've seen in the last few years, so a little bit more reduction from preliminaries to final levies. To put that 7.3% increase into context, last year's overall increase was almost 8%, 7.9%. Our three-year average is 7.7%, so just a little bit lower than what we've seen in the last few years. If you take a longer time frame and look at the last 10 years, the average was 4.3% for the last 10 years, so we're still significantly higher than our historical average. A lot of that 4.3%, though, is because of the big reduction from the big plan in 2001. If you take out that big reduction, the 10-year average is 5.6%, if you exclude the 1 year where we had the very big reduction when the school levies were reduced significantly. There's a chart at the bottom of the first page that shows the sort of share of levies by jurisdiction over the last 13, 14 years. And the thing that jumps out at, is the big change from 2001 to 2002 when the big plan was implemented. The state tax was put into place at that point, and school levies were significantly reduced. Other than that, the levies have been relatively stable, and that is adjusted for inflation. If you would take out the inflation adjustment, the whole bar chart would be climbing each year other than 2001 to 2002.
And, Mr. Ouellette, on the percent increases that we're talking about, if we have a three-year average that's 7.7 and then a 10-year average without 2001 that's 5.6, then the average of the years from 97 to 2003 minus must be about 3 or 4%.
Yeah, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but that's correct. If you would exclude the last 3 years, the average would be significantly lower than that that 4.3%. Yep. Well, maybe not significantly lower, but lower.
Lower.
Anyway.
Thank you.
Turning to specific jurisdictions, cities statewide are up 8.1%. Last year they were up 8.3%. Regional split, Greater Minnesota cities up almost 10%, 9.8%. Metro cities up 7.4%. There's a on the second page, there's a distribution of the percent of cities in different levy ranges, so you can get a sense of the variation. About a quarter of the cities have levies up more than 10%, and about 18% had a decline or a flat levy. So there's quite a bit of variation among the cities in terms of how big their levy increase was. If you take into account, if you look at revenue-based levy plus aid, the overall increase from last year to this year is 6.1%, and about 17% of cities had a levy plus aid increase more than 10%. So if you look at the combination of levy plus aid, that does moderate the increases a little bit. If there are no questions on that, on the next page, the counties is a similar distribution. Counties are up 6.6%, again, a little bit lower than last year. Counties were up 6.9% last year. Greater Minnesota, 7%. Metro counties, 6.3%. So a tighter range there than with the cities. And if you look at the distribution as well, also a tighter range with the counties where 10% of counties were up 10% or more. Most of them were between the 0 to 10% range. And if you look at levy plus aid for counties, again, it does reduce that increase a little bit to 6% levy plus aid increase from 2007 to 2008. And then finally, real quickly, a school district's increase is 7.6%, and that does reflect the impacts of the voter-approved levies. Last year it was 9.5%, so quite a bit lower than last year. And 67 of 99 districts that asked for operating referenda were at least partially successful in their referenda. So that's a quick highlight of the levies. I'll talk very briefly about market value trends, and then I'll get into the actual impacts on taxpayers when you combine the levies and the valuation trends. I have a couple of charts on the next page that show value trends. The first one shows the average annual increase in residential homestead value compared to all other types of property. And what you'll see is the last couple of years, residential property has increased less quickly in value than other types of property. This is a reverse of a 5 to 7 year trend before that, where homesteads were increasing in value more than the average or more than all other types of property. What this does, holding everything else equal, is it means that a little bit of property tax will be shifting away from homesteads to other types of property. So that's good news for homesteads, not so good news for the other types of property that are still increasing in value at a faster pace. Now, it's important to remember that the last numbers on this chart are the 07 valuations from January 2 of 07. Those are the ones that are being used for taxes payable 08. But these clearly are not reflecting what's going on in the market today. And the assessors that are going to follow me would be able to give you more information about what's going on the ground right now. But the property tax system has quite a bit of a lag. So the 08 taxes are still being spread on values that were set over a year ago. So these values don't fully reflect what's going on in the market today.
And Mr. Ouellette, I know this doesn't directly have to do with the levies, but has the department taken a look at what this drop in percent increase in value is doing to the limiting portion of?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the limited market value, we'll have that report done within the next couple of weeks, so we'll have the full report to you. But in short, a lot of the limited market value is coming back on the tax rolls, especially in the homestead. So this increase includes that limited market value coming back. So the fact that homesteads are only going up by a little bit over 5%, and that includes a bunch of limited value coming back on the tax rolls, indicates that the estimated values were really moderating even as of January 2nd of 07.
Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ouellette, in the second chart at the bottom, what properties in the category of other? I mean, initially I think of seasonal rec, but what else might be there?
Yep, Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, that also includes non-homestead residential, so your second homes and rental homes, as well as utility property, other sorts of miscellaneous categories. But the two that are driving that big increase are the cabins and the non-homestead residential property, and those are increasing by non-homestead residential 14.6%, and cabin 20%. So those are the ones that are really making that top bar really high.
Mr. Willett, cabins were how much?
20%.
20?
And that would include new construction as well as inflationary increases on existing cabin property. Okay. All right. If you turn to the next page, I'll quickly go through sort of the what these things mean for the taxpayers. This information is based on the preliminary levies, so this is overstated a little bit. We haven't had time to rerun the model with the final levies that we just got late last week. So these will be overstated just slightly for the preliminary levies, which are about $50 million higher than the final levies, as I said earlier. Our estimate is that for 08, existing homesteads, so if you exclude new construction and improvements on homesteads, existing homesteads are estimated on average to have about a 5.3% increase in 08 compared to 07. And then the table on the bottom shows the regional variation of those increases. The biggest increases are in the Duluth area and in Anoka County, which are between 10 and 11%. Most moderate increases are in Olmsted County, on the Iron Range, and in southeast Hennepin County. But even within these regions, there's going to be big variations from one jurisdiction to another, depending on the levies, whether there was a school referenda levy or other large levy increase. Statewide, the effective tax rate has bumped up for homesteads from 1.05% to 1.06%. It's the first time in several years that the effective tax rate on homes has gone up. It had been a steady decline for a number of years because values had been increasing faster than levies. And when values increase faster than levies, the effective tax rate drops. Because the values are moderating now, we saw a slight reversal in that trend. But still, that effective tax rate is much lower than it was 10 years ago when it was 1.4% of value. So that run-up in homestead values is really reflected in the effective tax rates. On the next page, this is kind of a new piece of information that we haven't looked at in exact the same way, and I'll just sort of go through it briefly. But this, we actually looked at some parcel-level data for a couple of sample communities to see for homesteads, how much variation is there within a community on the tax increases for homesteads. We generally present information as an average per jurisdiction, and as you know, the average can mask a lot of differences from one homestead to another. So what we tried to do was to show how big of a spread there is for the experience for all homesteads, both statewide and then for a couple of sample communities that I pulled out. If you look at the statewide distribution, the bulk of homesteads statewide are seeing an increase between 0 and 7%, but there's a lot of variation in that, and that can be because of a particular jurisdiction having a significant levy change, or it can also be because a parcel has a significant valuation change if there's new construction, or if they've got a lot of limited market value coming back on the tax rolls for that particular parcel. So that's why you see such a broad range in that statewide chart. If you look at Anoka County, the city of Anoka, that's a city where there was a significant operating referenda passed. So their chart is much higher. The average is hovering around 15%, and a lot of that is due to a very significant school referenda kicking in 2008. But the distribution is pretty tight. So most homesteads have a change that's pretty similar, plus or minus 5%, but it's a very high increase because of a levy change. A very different experience in the city of Bemidji, where you've really got two peaks, one at the 0% range and one at the 15% range. And what's going on here is that there's more variation in value changes for homesteads at the parcel level. The levy increase was smaller, but where you see that spike at 15%, that's homes where limited market value is coming back on the tax rolls, and that valuation increase is capped at around 15% because of the way the limited market value law works. So you've got some homes, a significant chunk, about 12%, right at that 15% range, and those are ones where they previously had limited market value and it's coming back in the tax rolls. So it's kind of a complicated chart, but it's a way to get a feel for what's beyond the average for a particular jurisdiction, that within a jurisdiction you're still going to have homes above and below that average.
And, Mr. Ouellette, this chart doesn't tell us anything about the value of the homes that are in the 30% that's having a 0% increase and the 15% that are having a, you know, a 15% increase, I guess. It doesn't talk about...
No, we did
don't
similar...
Know anything about it. All they are is numbers.
Right. We did similar charts for the estimated market value and the taxable market value for these jurisdictions so we could see where the variation was in those. And we even did a cross-tab where we tried to see if homes at different values were having a different experience. So if you're interested in that, we can dig into that in more detail. But for the purposes of an overview, I thought I would stick with just the net tax impact of all the various influences, value changes, limited value coming back on, levy changes that add up to the net tax change.
Well, and Mr. Ouellette, so if this is the limited market value properties coming back on, they would be properties that have had fast increasing of values in the past number of years, and now the values are slowing down.
That's correct.
Yep. Thank you.
On the next page is just sort of the rest of the results of the model run for other types of property. And what you see is like with the market value changes, the largest increases in net tax are in the seasonal rec, residential non-homestead, and in ag land, which also has seen pretty significant increases in value. Again, that does include new construction, so those increases include the addition of new construction in those categories. Existing homes, 5.3%, as I mentioned. If you include new construction, homesteads statewide increasing by 6.8% compared to last year. Okay. The next chart is one just to keep in mind the larger context of the property tax system. This is a long-term look at property taxes as a share of total of major state and local taxes. The property tax in 08 will estimated to be about 28.6% of the total of the major taxes. And that's been creeping up the last couple of years after a big decrease with the big plan. And if you look historically prior to the Minnesota miracle, back in the early 60s, the property tax was more than half. So it's still much, much lower than it was 50 years ago. And then the final thing in the packet, which was not in the handout that the public got, are a couple of maps of the model run. Again, this is preliminary levies, not final levies. It's increases in net tax, percent change for existing value homesteads is the first map, and for all property is the second map. It's by school district so that the areas are big enough to see what color they are. We can do a similar one by city and township or by county total if that's of interest to you. But this just gives you a sort of a regional look at where increases are higher and where they're lower. The hatching, the cross marks are where a school referenda levy passed last fall. So you can see the connection between some of the bigger increases and whether there was a school referendum levy that passed. So the first one is just the existing homesteads, how big of an increase they had, and the second one is all property. And the second one has a lot more consistent increases across because you're masking the shifts between types of property that can be show up in the first map. That is, in a whirlwind overview, major property tax trends. If you have any questions, I can field those now.
Thank you, Mr. Ouellette. Questions? Members and to the folks in the audience, in your packets for the members is charts that we had from last year. And when we were having discussions last year about the property taxes and the property tax trends, we had a lot of discussion about the relationship that the levies have with the aids that are paid by the state. And I just want to refresh everybody's memory about the consistency of these graphs that shows that as the AIDS goes down, the levies go up. And so when we're looking at these percent increases, and we do notice that a little bit in your discussion on the levy and aid portion that does moderate the property tax increase some, but I certainly want the members to be cognizant and aware of the importance of this relationship as we go forward and work on the property taxes this session. Now, Mr. Wallet, did I hear that there were a couple of assessors that wanted to talk on this?
Yes. So we'll have the county assessors come forward.
Mr. Kua. Good morning, Mr. Kua.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thanks for letting us have an opportunity to meet. I've got three colleagues with me this morning. What we'd like to do is briefly touch on some valuation trends around the state and then talk a little bit about some foreclosure activity and give a picture of how that is focused primarily in the metro area, but it's kind of covered statewide. My name is Steve Kuha. I'm the Cass County Assessor, also chair of our State Assessors Organization Legislative Committee. And just briefly regarding foreclosure activities in northern Minnesota and particularly in Cass County, it's hitting us every place. We read about it in the paper all the time and nationwide, statewide. Our activity in Cass County, for example, in 2006, we had about 65 foreclosures or cancellation of contracts. They basically are the same thing, just one through a lender and another one through private parties. But where the deals fell through and the vendor or the lender ended up with the property. And we had about 65 of those in 2006 and about 115 in 2007. So percentage-wise, we had a huge increase in the numbers. However, the numbers themselves are still relatively small compared to our total households in the county. As far as valuation trends, what we're seeing in outstate, particularly I'll comment on northern Minnesota, the lakeshore properties are still holding their own pretty well. We're not seeing a dramatic decline in sale prices in those sectors. Our rural residential properties are suffering, and our small town residential properties are suffering. Values are going down, not a great deal, but 5-10%. We're looking at maybe some 15% decreases in some areas. Our small town commercial is slow, but the values seem to be holding their own as well. One sector that we are seeing continued increase in values when we look at sale prices, and that is in our rural acreage sales, farmland or rural hunting acreages that are selling. Those markets are still pretty strong, and the prices are still continuing to increase a little bit, not as rapidly as we have seen over the past 5 or 10 years, but certainly still a pretty strong market. The number of transactions is way down, however. In 2004, 2005, before things really started to slide, those were pretty strong years, and we're down 40% in our number of transactions in 2007 compared to 2004 and 2005. 2006 was the year where things started to slip, and so definitely the activity is down, and the values are soft, and but still a little bit of strength in those markets that I mentioned, in rural acreage in particular. I think for brevity, I will cease my comments at this point and turn it over to Tom Hauslog.
And Mr. Kua, do you feel, you're kind of right in the middle of the northern part up there. Is Cass pretty representative of what's going on to the west and east of you?
Mr. Chairman, I think for the most part, I think we do represent maybe the easterly part of the state a little bit more than the west. We get into much better farm country and farmland as we move west through, west of Hubbard and Clearwater counties. We start getting into more, better farm country. And our farmland is marginal in Cass County, but we do, with the lakes and the timber, we represent the northeastern part of the state probably a little bit closer.
Well, I was thinking that with the commodity prices, perhaps the ag land values were holding pretty strong in the western part of the state also. Do you have a feel for that?
Mr. Chairman, yes. I believe even in Cass County, where the ag land is marginal, you know, commodity prices are still dictating some decisions that are made. We've got quite a bit of pasture land as well for cattle, I think the markets certainly influence what the farmers are doing when it comes time to transactions.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm Tom Hauslug, Rock County Land Records Director. I do have a handout here for committee members and some excess.
We'll get a page. Go ahead, Mr. Hauslug.
Okay. Again, I'm Tom Hauslug, Rock County Land Records Director. For those of you that are unfamiliar, Rock County is located in the extreme southwest corner of Minnesota. We're bordered on the south by Iowa, bordered on the west by South Dakota. The county seat is the city of Luverne. We're a relatively small, agricultural, predominantly oriented county. The county seat of Luverne is about 5,000 people. And we have about a little bit under 300,000 acres of farmland, which is predominantly corn and soybeans. What I want to do is kind of walk you through the trend of what's happened with the agricultural market in the last 3, 4, 5 years. Rock County passed the $2,000 per acre transaction, and these are transactions from farmers to farmers for farming operations. January 2003, we saw farmland pass the $2,000 per acre sale. $3,000 was passed on April 2004. $4,000 an acre was passed on December 2005. $5,000 an acre was passed on October 2006. The $6,000 level for farmland was passed in February of 2007. And we've just crossed the $7,000 per acre sale in February of 2008. That amount was $7,800 an acre, and that took place last Saturday, in fact. You were talking about commodity prices. The commodity prices in the city of Luverne yesterday, corn closed at 5 1/4 a bushel. Soybeans were at $13.05 a bushel. These prices are basically as high as they've been since, at least in our area, since 1997, 1998, and that was at a time when there were just crop shortages out there. Futures prices, corn, if you look at the November futures prices for corn, they're marketing corn at $5.70 a bushel. Futures prices for soybeans in that same time frame are $14.25. So you can see what's driving the demand partially for why they're paying the prices that they're doing. We're hearing futures prices that people are paying for corn to $6 to $7 a bushel, and soybeans from $16 to $17 a bushel for 2 to 3 years out in the future. So the contracting these prices, you can see the effect that we've had on farmland, how fast we're raising in terms of what farmland is selling for. Our residential market in southwest Minnesota, certainly in our area, is continued to be very stable, still a strong market. Our foreclosure situation is basically average. We see no spikes that you see in the metropolitan area. It's very stable.
Very, very good. If I had realized that you were coming here from Rock County, I wouldn't have asked Mr. Kuhl about the ag land, but I see that now. Thank you. Questions? Okay, who's next? Mr. Baker?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Stephen Baker, the Ramsey County Assessor. And as Mr. Kuhl said, Tom May and I are going to talk just briefly about kind of foreclosures and some of those market impacts, how we see them affecting the assessment. I want to talk a little bit about what got us into the foreclosure fix, too. I think it's helpful to understand what got us here. One of the concerns that we have in my office is we don't fully still understand the ramifications of what's happening. We can't really predict fully where we're going with the number of foreclosures. I will say I've been very encouraged at the level of communication and cooperation between governmental entities trying to gather around this topic. Tom's, I think, has got a copy of a task force report from Hennepin County. Ramsey County has formed a foreclosure task force, and both the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul are working very hard on it. I think Minneapolis passed some ordinances last night to try to address some of these issues. But it's still unclear as to how much of this, how strong this force is, and whether and how much we can really slow it down and divert it. So I started with a slide just kind of talking about what we did in Ramsey County this year on the assessment. And while it's difficult to isolate the impact of foreclosures from the other general market forces, I can say that we're reducing our residential values in aggregate about 6% in Ramsey County this year, which is about $2.2 billion worth of residential value. Now, that's estimated market value, not taxable. So taxable value will shrink less because of new construction and limited market value. We had about 45,000 parcels with limited value last year. For now, for payable 09, we're going to be down to about 6,000. So between falling prices and the formula phasing out limited, limited is going to go away much more quickly, it appears, than we would have thought a couple of years ago. But I still haven't seen totals on that yet in terms of how the values really shake out. So we reduced values about $2.2 billion. Originally, they were going down about $2 billion, and then we took an additional look at the neighborhoods where we were seeing a high aggregation or high percentage of foreclosure activity and vacant property occurring. These neighborhoods were typically all in St. Paul, and we made some additional adjustments in those areas to our assessed values, feeling that the sales that we have based the 2008 assessment on really don't fully include all the impacts from foreclosure. So that was about another $200 or $220 million to single-family homes in St. Paul in those neighborhoods, just to try to make sure we correctly include those influences. So, you know, what are some of the other consequences of foreclosure? Really, you know, for individuals and families, it's their lost equity. We're seeing the beginnings, potentially, of a new cycle of poverty for some of these families, homelessness. For our communities, we're certainly seeing increased public costs, maintenance of buildings and boarding up buildings, that sort of thing. St. Paul's having some problems with collecting. They can levy a special assessment for some of those costs, but they're not collecting them fully, and so they're having a budget shortfall. So it's creating some hardship there. We're seeing some weakening of the neighborhood commercial nodes and strips, which is concerning because I think those have been a key component of some of the vitality and resurgence of both the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And it'd be unfortunate if we reverse some of those gains. I think there's a lot of fear that it's going to contribute to a decline in home ownership rates, and it certainly looks like that's likely. I don't know that we can predict that fully yet, but certainly seems quite possible. You know, the general market conditions, we have the weakening equity markets. Certainly the loss in market liquidity and credit crisis is impacting real estate in general, and that's a big part of some of the value declines we're seeing. And lastly, I think that we're really starting to get into kind of a negative economic feedback loop on real estate, and all this stuff kind of feeds itself. And that's where I think those of us that are in a position to affect any changes, if we can somehow, you know, mitigate that loop, I think, to where it becomes a kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, it's going to help us. You know, right now it's people read all the bad news and then they don't buy or they want to pay less, or now we're starting to see some markets with people have negative equity in homes, they're just starting to walk away. That's a new phenomenon for foreclosures now. Otherwise, strong credit risks, they're walking away from properties because they owe more on the property than it's worth. There's been some predictions that the Alt-A, there's a prime group of borrowers that are in the suburbs. We may see some growth in the suburban foreclosures as well. And I passed out a map of Ramsey County foreclosures, and I think you can see where there's really no area of the county that's totally immune to them. There's certainly a preponderance of them in St. Paul, but, I mean, you'll see foreclosures in White Bear Lake and North Oaks and Shoreview and throughout the county, and that trend seems to be continuing. On page 2 of the handout that I had that started with the market impacts and foreclosure, there's a couple charts that were put together by the Washington County Recorder with information assembled from the metro area recorder's offices. And the first one is sorted by percentage change. And the second one is just basically in the same order, Carver down through Hennepin County. And you can see the – yes, Mr. Chair, you've got it there, I think. So you'll see really percentage change-wise, Scott has a much fewer number. Scott County has much fewer number of foreclosures. They have the largest percentage change from 03 to 07, and Carver has the lowest percentage change. Dakota, Ramsey, and Hennepin, the three largest counties, are kind of right in the middle of about a 400% to 500% increase during that period.
Senator Buck.
Mr. Chairman, do we know what percentage of these foreclosures are actually?
You know, I don't have that data. We could try to get some of that data. I could get that data perhaps for Ramsey. I know Hennepin has done some of that information. Maybe Tom has a comment on that.
I'll cover that in my
notes. And the question that I was going to come to was, you know, if the values were, well, too high, and so now the values have all been reduced, and interest rates are still, relatively low, are you seeing any sign of, so the values have come down, the interest rates are still low, these homes are much more affordable now, or is there any sign of people getting into the market that haven't been, or think because values are down they can? Any sign of that at all?
Mr. Chair, I think we're seeing still and have seen that if a house is in really good condition and is well priced, it will typically sell. The problem is that there's so many more homes on the market than there are buyers that anything that really isn't well positioned in the marketplace, either by condition and remodeling and pricing, is probably not going to sell. And it really is that kind of typical, law of supply and demand that's influencing things. And so those homes then that don't fit that upper echelon, they have a difficult time finding a buyer and consequently either are pulled off the market or sell at a steep discount.
And how many of those homes sit vacant?
I do have a slide on that in St. Paul. So coming up, I think it's the next slide on page 3, it would be my slide 5. We had about 2,352 foreclosures in Ramsey County in 2007. I put this information together for another presentation I did. So of those 2,352, only 100 were condominiums, 61 were townhouses, 17 were foreclosures by owners associations on properties. Some of those might have been in concert with a bank foreclosure at the same time, so they don't necessarily mean an additional one or additional property being foreclosed. So then the balance would typically be either single-family homes or multi-family properties, meaning two or three unit, doubles or triplexes. Or in St. Paul, sometimes it's two buildings on one lot or three buildings on one lot, not the traditional duplex. So, and then on January 1st, there was 1,591 vacant homes in St. Paul, which is up substantially. And I think Minneapolis is seeing a similar upsurge in vacant homes and trying to get their arms around how to manage this situation. And it's one of the reasons we're seeing the lawsuits proposed from some governmental entities, because with the syndication of the mortgages, it's hard to find sometimes a responsible party. And the cities are really are struggling with that. How do we figure out, who to even contact to get control of this property? And there's some delay. They have some rights, but if they have to go through their, kind of exercise their police power rights before they can take action, it causes some additional delay. So they're hoping to somehow work out a relationship with some of the lenders where they can get in on some of these properties more quickly, stabilize them before as much damage is done, and trim the cycle a little bit. And then there's a chart, I think Tom will have more on the Hennepin County foreclosures. And, I don't know, we need to get into really the foreclosure rates, the rising cause, unless you want to. I included some information on that. I will say that I heard somebody comment the other day that, a lot of folks will say, well, these people entered into these deals, it's their fault. But very few people went into a lender asking for some of these really exotic loan packages. These were products that were created by the lending, by the mortgage industry, and sold to folks. And I think a lot of people trust that when they're sitting across from a mortgage banker, they're getting good advice. Yeah. And so they bought into some of these loans, especially the high use of adjustable rate mortgages at a time of all-time low interest rates really seems to be a very much a disconnect that's kind of leading into this problem now. The issue of inflated appraisals has been something that's gotten a fair amount of play. The government has tried to step in and act on that. They've now set some rules that the loan officers can no longer be the one ordering the appraiser ordering the appraisal from the appraiser, which then means they can't put as much pressure on the appraiser to come in at the right number, or they're not going to get the next appraisal order from that loan officer. And then the last slide is kind of your, Mr. Chair, your question about home ownership on page 5 is this was a chart put together by the Center for Responsible Lending. And, you know, I will say I was guilty of this thinking, well, at least with subprime lending, more people got in homes than otherwise could have. And they're not foreclosing on everything, so some folks are still winners. And there probably are a few. Unfortunately, there's so many refinanced properties being foreclosed that overall there is a net home ownership loss from prior to the crisis. And it's all these forces that are giving, I think, assessors in the metro area some concerns that we could be in for some market changes that are pretty atypical for us. And so we're really working hard at making sure we can track the market as closely as we can, given the tools and the techniques that are available.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Baker. And I imagine that you're going to have a number of homeowners that are experiencing this value decline and are going to have the be part of this 7% property tax increase that aren't going to be very pleased with the outcome of the decline in value plus the increase in property taxes. And
Mr. Chair, my staff took a lot of calls this year from folks who didn't understand how their market value could be going down and their taxable value could be going up. That was a significant concern, and that will still be the case this year, hopefully not to the extent it was this past year. But my experience has also been there's a lot of folks that do not want to see their assessed values go down. They take that news very hard as well. So we'll get a lot of calls from folks that are upset that we've lowered their value and then somehow diminished their net worth. Yeah. And really, you know, the message there is we're trying to follow the market. We're not setting the market. We're not establishing the true value of their property. We're just trying to reflect what that value that's been established by the market is. But it's a piece that gets lost for folks.
Thank you. Mr. May.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom May. I'm the Hennepin County Assessor. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers Legislative Committee. I'm going to talk a little bit about foreclosures in Hennepin County to give you kind of a scope of what's happening in Hennepin, and then talk a little bit about some of the responses that we're seeing, and then also a little bit about the market and what's happening in Hennepin County. A handout I have has a chart on the first page and then some maps. The first chart will show you a history of foreclosures in Hennepin County and illustrate that we normally have had about 1,000 foreclosures a year in Hennepin County. If you look back to 2003 and 2004, we were in that 1,000 to 1,100 range. 2006, we were over 3,000, and for 2007, we had 5,661 foreclosures. You may have also seen that the Hennepin County Sheriff released a press release just last week that said in January they actually had 711 foreclosure sales in that 1 month. It was an all-time high. So the numbers are certainly there. The second page is a map of Hennepin County and the foreclosures for 2007. And as Mr. Baker had mentioned, it's not only a foreclosure problem in Minneapolis. You can see that foreclosures are spread across the whole county. And there's not a city in the county that doesn't have at least a foreclosure to deal with in the city. But, of course, you can also see where the concentration of foreclosures are. The third map is Minneapolis, showing the 2007 foreclosures. So you can get an idea of the concentrations, where they occurred. Minneapolis had 2,895 foreclosures in 2007. The last map is a map of the north side of Minneapolis, and it's foreclosures from the middle of August of last year through January of this year, and you can see the concentration per block of the number of foreclosures that have occurred. One of the interesting things, if you look at those, and to answer Senator Bach's question, if you look at Hennepin County in 2007, about 40% of the foreclosures were non-owner occupied. If you go to the city of Minneapolis, that number is actually 60%. So a lot of investor-type rental properties were in that foreclosure number for 2007. 60%. In a response to that, the Hennepin County Board last summer established a foreclosure task force to look at the whole issue and see what kind of response, county government agencies around the county could have to kind of help out in the situation. The report was published in October of 2007. That report is available on Hennepin County's website. If you look under reports, you can find that. And it was really broken down into three areas. The first area is how to respond to individuals, and especially with 60% of the properties being non-owner occupied, a lot of issues with renters who all of a sudden were displaced from these homes, probably didn't know their rights under foreclosure laws that they could remain in the home for the redemption period, and a lot of things like that. So a lot of effort into that area, and of course another burden on county resources to try to deal with that issue. The second area of the report was on neighborhoods and communities, and really to try to deal with some of these spillover effects that start to occur. And the spillover effect in the foreclosure is when the non-foreclosed homes start to suffer because of the predominance of foreclosures, of maybe boarded homes, vacant homes in the neighborhood, so that their market values are starting to be affected and other things in the community. And the third part of the report is dealing with financial entities, seeing what could be done with some of the holders of these mortgages and the financial agencies to see if there's some response. Of course, there's been a lot of that happening here in the last several months with some of the financial entities, if the owners can actually find out who holds their mortgage, and that seems to be one of the problems. There's another report that's been published, and it was published by the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund and Housing Link. I think the last update was October of 2007, that talks about foreclosure statewide. A lot of statistics on every county. And as was mentioned before, there are foreclosures across the state. The interesting thing, if you look at that, there's a comparison in that report that's on either of those websites that compares your number of foreclosures to the number of households. And interestingly enough, if you rank counties statewide, Hennepin actually ends up number 10 in the percentage of foreclosures per households. There's nine counties that actually have higher foreclosure rates compared to their number of homes in that. From an assessor standpoint, one thing that we're doing as a state association in concert with the Department of Revenue is we've prepared a foreclosure document that is an advisory to assessors, a refresher on how to deal with foreclosure sales or foreclosure influence sales, which could be anywhere from a deed in lieu of foreclosure, short sales that you see prior to a foreclosure, REO sales, which are real estate owned, or once the bank actually comes into title after the redemption period, those sales, and auction sales that we're starting to see a lot more of. So it goes through each of those types of sales and lets assessors statewide have some documentation of how to handle those and how they should read those as far as their market that they're trying to analyze. I think the biggest issue that from the assessment perspective and what we're grappling with in Hennepin is that right now we have 30% fewer sales than we had last year. I think Steve Kuha mentioned that they even have a larger percentage decrease with that. And of course, we're historians, assessors are always looking at sales that have already occurred, and we're still held to the standard that we need to look at sales that have occurred in the last year to establish January 2nd, 2008. So we've got a lot of issues with trying to look at that set of market data and also look at the current market and try to put that all together to come up with our 2008 assessment. Foreclosures present a problem for assessors because of the condition of these properties. I would say that very few of these properties that are in foreclosures are what you would call a move-in condition, or the condition that the assessor was dealing with on January 2nd, 2007. One agency that deals with homes in North Minneapolis, looking at purchasing these, putting them back into the market for first-time homebuyers, a person there looked at 117 homes in North Minneapolis, and out of that, three of them were in move-in condition. So it gives you a little idea that most of these have some issues with them that have to be addressed. Right now in Hennepin, our appraisers are out looking at these foreclosures, trying to grasp the condition they're in so that we can be a little proactive on the 2008 assessment with adjusting these. Just a few examples. We have everything from, in Minneapolis, maybe a boarded-up house with all the mechanicals missing that have been taken out, to brand-new houses, 1 or 2 years old, that now are in foreclosure and have major, major damage. We have a house in Champlin that's basement's full of water, and I suspect is ice, not water. We have a brand-new house in Broken Park that originally sold for over $800,000 that has frozen water cascading down the side. The interior probably has $250,000 and more damage to it from water breakage. And we even have a house in Mound that's on Lake Minnetonka that's a new house, $1.3 million sold for. That's basement now has 890,000 gallons of water in it. So it's a large spectrum of properties we're dealing with, and they all aren't as straightforward as just putting them on the market and selling them. They all have different degrees of problems. So we're trying to look at that and how they affect the other market. For 2008, just to give you an idea, in Hennepin County, we have a lot of jurisdictions that the market is okay. It's holding its own. It's flat. Most of our suburban cities probably have an overall residential value impact of between flat and down 4%. That's probably the range, although in each city you'll have neighborhoods that differ from that. But once you get to the areas that have the larger numbers of foreclosure, through North Minneapolis, through Brooklyn Center, up into Brooklyn Park in some areas, they're going to have a larger impact on their market value from that spillover effect. I talked to Patrick Todd in the city of Minneapolis. In the north side, those non-foreclosure houses or existing homes probably are going to see double-digit decreases, in some instances up to 30% decreases in their market value, which is very, very significant. Once we leave residential, apartments are pretty much flat in value in the county, although our investment grade Class A high quality apartments still have upside. Those will be moving up a little bit. Our commercial industrial market is still strong. Our office, large warehouse, probably there's an upward trend there. Our retail is still fairly strong. So we will see some upward adjustments in our commercial industrial. Overall, when we get done, I think we'll probably be somewhere around a flat line if you add in all our new construction. We'll probably be between that flat or down 2% kind of overall when we look at the assessment. So.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. May. Questions? Well, thank you, assessors, for the update there. We appreciate that. And I think we're going to leave the levy impacts and the foreclosure discussion and move to the Green Acres report that the legislative auditor worked on. As you know, members, the department has been working on Green Acres as an issue for us to deal with. The legislative auditor this last year has taken a good look at it and has a report for us to consider. But there are just a few numbers that have been standing out in my mind. And one of them is there's $10 billion of value being sheltered. There's $30 to $40 million of taxes that are not being paid. And of that, those numbers, 38% of that Green Acres land is non-tillable agriculture. And so I think it's real important that we take a look at what the auditor is doing, review what the department has done in the past. There still is a group that has been working on that. And I would like to think that by the end of this session, we can find some solutions to make this a viable program if we keep the program at all. The other thing in your packet is the language that we had in our bill last year, and I'm not going to go into what that is because I think after the auditor has presented, we will see that we need to make some changes there also. But we have been working on this for a while, and I think it's pretty important that we figure out what we're going to do. Senator Ma.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Before we move into that, I've been sitting here. It's a little bit staggering to get the information that we've just gotten from the assessors. And in fact, it's a little bit hard to breathe right now. I haven't seen all those charts, both in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I just want to share with the property tax division members that, you know, tonight in the Judiciary Committee, we're going to be doing a double shift. We're going to be meeting this afternoon and then on through tonight to consider a foreclosure package of about maybe 15 bills that will be coming through to look at the foreclosure process. And that will help in some way. But at the end of the day, what matters to us here in this committee, which is how do we stabilize the valuation process and the property tax base, I don't know to what extent we can really help with that issue with the bills that are coming through the Judiciary Committee. And I think the assessors are absolutely right. You know, earlier you said, well, interest rates are low and we have the homes, so, you know, can we get people back into the homes? And one of the issues is the deterioration issue, that people can't readily move into those homes without putting a lot of money into it. But the other issue, too, is that there's such a credit squeeze right now. The credit market is so tight that I think in the past when a new homeowner wanted to move into one of these properties, it was a lot easier to be able to get into those properties. And I think the pendulum in the credit market has sort of swung to the point where it is almost impossible to get a loan now. So there are multiple issues from multiple directions that are keeping our properties vacant, unoccupied, and not being moved off the market. The other thing that I found interesting in all the discussions that we've talked about in terms of foreclosure is that the Mr. May referred to the fact that a number of the properties are investor-owned or where we have a lot of renters. And yet in all of the 15 or 16 bills that we've looked at to address foreclosure, there's been very little discussion from the landlord community. And I have asked whether or not, you know, there's an entity out there who is working with small investors or the investor owners out there. Because we're putting our efforts into helping the family-owned, you know, owner-occupied buildings. But what I'm hearing statistically is that many of these buildings that are going to foreclosure are actually not, you know, owner-occupied. And who's working with those investors to work with their lenders to try to see if we can keep people in their homes? And all of this, you know, Mr. Chair, in a context that in the last 6 years that I've been here at the legislature, we've had a housing crisis. We've been in a housing crisis. We've not been able to have people move into homes, or we've had an affordable housing crisis where people can't find homes. People can't find an affordable apartment to live in, even as a renter. So I think that there's an opportunity here for us to think through a little bit about some creative permanent solutions beyond, you know, I mean, I think the foreclosure crisis sends the signals that there are many, many things that we have to look at. And Representative Karen Clark and I have done some thinking, and I have a bill to look at whether or not we could take advantage of this opportunity to perhaps create, you know, an instrument like a land trust, you know, where we could take a number of parcels and number in a square block and put the land in a trust, but allow people to purchase the building that's on top of it, and that would be their mortgage. So it would be easier and more affordable for people to qualify to purchase that. And then, you know, but the land is in a trust. And, I mean, I think we have to come up with creative ways that beyond the foreclosure crisis, we help to permanently address the issue of vacancy. I mean, in Minneapolis and St. Paul, I think the foreclosure crisis just enhanced and magnified the vacancy crisis for us. We've always had that, and we've been struggling to find ways to deal with that. And so I know that in some of the beyond this package of foreclosure policy bills that we're putting together, I think there's going to be some property bills that will be coming through the division, maybe not this year, but it will be worked over the summer, and I hope that members of the division will be willing to participate in that conversation.
Yes, and thank you, Senator Moore. And you know, you're right. We do need to work to try to find ways to stabilize the values of these properties. And, you know, perhaps we should work with Senator Tomasoni and his division and see if there's something that can be accomplished there. And you know, it's important. I think at some point the largest issue is the one that the auditors were bringing forward, that their houses are not fit to sell as they are, and how do you address that? Senator Buck.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we need to be careful because, I mean, some of the problem that we've had building affordable housing and making sure people could get into housing is the fact that I personally think that housing prices have been run up too high and the market was in need of some kind of a correction downward. And I think we're going to see some of that. The question is, how much is it going to correct? But, I mean, I think we all have to admit there was an awful lot of speculation going on. And too many people got into buying equity, I think, thinking the pendulum was never going to come swing back, that it's just going to – this equity wave is going to continue to ride up, and I can make money without going to work. And I think some people are finding out that they didn't know enough about finance. But, the correction that we're going to see, it's not all downside, because there is going to create, when prices correct, some opportunity for people that couldn't get into housing before. Their payments are going to adjust when values come down, and there's going to be more opportunity for some people. So I think we need to be a little careful that we let the market go through the correction, because I think low interest rates to some degree and a tight market drove prices up to a point where I think now they're going to correct some. And I think we need to make sure the market has some time to do that before we get too far interfering in that. Just a word of caution.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Bach, I think that that will happen. But, you know, for those of us who live in Minneapolis and St. Paul, we now have a lot of people who don't have homes, who've been kicked out of their homes, particularly the renters. And if we had a housing crisis before for people who are renters or who are having a hard time getting to home, we're having a really hard time right now trying to find places for those people to live. And the other piece of it is that we, you know, the feds have dramatically cut back and their assistance to us in terms of public housing, and leaving a lot of that to the state and local government, and we can't do anything with that. I mean, we, given our fiscal problems. And so it isn't just the market adjusting and this foreclosure. I mean, I've maintained that a lot of the foreclosure is just giving us a different lens to really enhance the discussion on housing. But I think we've been in a housing crunch and housing crisis for a long time. And the disinvestments, both at the federal level and our inability to subsidize a lot of the housing needs at the state level because of the fiscal situations that we've had to face, I think has compounded this situation. It has given the enticement market an opportunity to capitalize and exploit the people who needed to get into housing. If somebody came to you and said, well, you can't rent, but if you were to go into this loan and you're paying lower than if you were renting for a four-bedroom for $1,400, but I can get you into a loan where you only pay $700 and you own your own home, I think that's the situation that we're looking at. And so while the market is correcting, I think that there is a recognition that the dynamics that existed for some of those exploitations and opportunities to occur continue to exist because we don't have, we have not been adequately addressing the housing crisis in the state.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Buck,
much of the problem revolves around the fact that we're not growing personal income in this state. I mean, wages are stagnant. And if you look at the number of what inflation has done to, for instance, the minimum wage, I mean, it has deteriorated significantly over the last couple of decades. And some of this problem will take care of itself if we can do something about growing personal income for people. So couple things need to happen, but I think we do need to admit for the record that Minnesota's doing better than most places. I mean, we have, I think, probably the highest home ownership rates in the country. But we certainly want to do better, but I don't want people watching on television to think that somehow we're failing, because as a state, we really are doing better than most places. And I think we just kind of need to keep that in mind as we move forward.
And members, a couple weeks we're going to have a discussion from the department about 4D housing, and maybe we'll expand it to include other housing issues. But I think for right now we're going to move on and listen to the legislative auditor's report on Green Acres.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jody Hauer. I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. I'd also like to acknowledge Dan Jacobson, my colleague who worked with me on this evaluation. I'm going to start by giving you just a brief overview of what our findings were in this study, and then get into a little bit more detail on the Green Acres program. So overall, for the Green Acres program, we concluded that the program does effectively equalize taxes for the people who are enrolled in the Green Acres program, but it doesn't help everyone who might be eligible, and I'll get back to that in a moment. We think it's unclear whether the program's goals include benefiting certain owners and certain types of land that now are eligible. So, for instance, some people who are not farmers are currently eligible for the benefits from the Green Acres program. The program has some eligibility criteria that are not workable, and the Green Acres program has not been implemented consistently around the state. Regarding the preservation of farmland, Minnesota's two programs for preserving farmland can help to stage development or to shape it in the areas where the program is in place. But we've concluded that the programs are inadequate to preserve farmland for the long term. And I'll get back to that in a moment, but first I'll spend more time on the Green Acres program per se. I think this division is aware that the Green Acres program applies only to land where non-agricultural factors have influenced the price of the farmland. So things like development pressures jack up the price of the farmland, and that's the only place where the Green Acres program will apply. And to be eligible, the owner has to meet certain requirements. There are ownership requirements. There's a requirement that the land produce a certain amount of income each year, and the land has to be classified as agricultural. It has to be at least 10 acres in size or be a greenhouse or nursery, and the land has to be primarily in agricultural use. Now, overall, we found that the Green Acres program does effectively equalize taxes, and it does this because it significantly reduces the value of the farmland enrolled in the program. The Green Acres land is valued according to its agricultural use, not according to the highest and best use that assessors typically use when they're setting the values on the land. And the difference between those two can be quite large. In 2007, we found that in the four-county area, fast-growing counties just immediately north of the Twin Cities area, the average value for an acre of farmland there was $6,500. But for land in the Green Acres program there, the Green Acres program reduced the value of that farmland to $1,900. And that's a threefold difference. So it's a significant reduction in the value of that property. And, of course, due to the lower taxable values, the owners of the land in the program pay less in taxes. And we estimated that in 2007, the program did reduce taxes for the participants by $35 million around the state. Beyond the tax benefits, there are special assessment benefits because the special assessments are deferred, typically until the owner sells the land. And when the land is sold, the owner then is required to pay back 3 years' worth of the tax break, but any tax break that occurred in the years prior to that represents a permanent tax break for the landowner. Now, even though we think that the program is effective overall in equalization, we do think it has some limits. And first of all, the Green Acres program has not been implemented statewide. Again, that's not news to members of this division. 35 counties do not have land enrolled in the program, even though some of the county assessors in those 35 counties told us that non-agricultural factors have indeed affected the values of land, at least in some parts of their counties. Now, this map shows what percentage of farmland in each county is enrolled in the program. The counties in white are those without any land enrolled. One exception I have to point out is Hennepin County. There are Green Acres and lands in Hennepin, but we don't have township-level data on the farmland acreage in Hennepin, so that's an anomaly. The darkest green in this map represents the largest concentrations of Green Acres land enrolled. And second, we think the program's effectiveness on equalization is limited because certain landowners simply don't apply. Some aren't interested. Some mistrust government programs. Some are in a position where they might be soon selling their land. For a variety of reasons, a number of people who might otherwise be eligible don't apply. And then third, not all landowners who might be eligible are aware of the program. We interviewed the county assessors in 48 of the counties that have Green Acres land enrolled. Five of those counties have relatively low amounts of land enrolled in the program, and the counties don't provide information about the program unless they're requested for information from the landowners. By contrast, most of the other counties will send a mailing or in some other way try to notify the potentially eligible landowners about the program. Now, besides equalization, we looked at the program's effect on preserving farmland. Again, I think division members here realize that the law itself does not explicitly state that farmland preservation is a goal of the Green Acres program, but a lot of people consider it to be one of the program's objectives. So we looked at how well does it do that, and we concluded that the program does not effectively preserve farmland for a couple of reasons. First, it doesn't require any kind of a long-term commitment to the land by the owner. The program is not restricted to regions that are zoned for long-term agricultural use. Owners can divide their land, sell it at any point. The program does not restrict them in that way. The amount of the tax benefit, although it can be large for an individual landowner, it's small when you compare it to the rapid rise in farmland values over time. And this harkens back to what you heard from Mr. Kuha and Mr. Hauslog and others who testified before me. I'll give you one example. The average 80-acre farm, again, looking at those four counties, the fast-growing counties immediately north of the metropolitan area, 80-acre farm there back in 1993 was worth $62,000. Well, it increased to $520,000 as of last year, so from $62,000 up to $520,000 in that 13-year period. Now, the average benefit for that 80-acre farm that's in the Green Acres program was $1,350 last year, and that benefit would have been somewhat less for each of the preceding years. So the value obviously grew at a far greater rate than might otherwise be expected, and it far outweighs the value of the tax benefit. And then finally, the program's effect on preserving farmland is somewhat tenuous because it's not targeted to high-quality land. It's not just prime farmland. It can also be mediocre land that's involved in the program, and nor is it targeted to land that's at risk of soon being developed. So those things limit its ability to be effective at preserving farmland for agricultural uses over the long term. Now, I also want to talk about some of the controversies over who is eligible for the Green Acres benefits. And we concluded that it's unclear whether the program's goals really include benefiting some of the landowners and some of the types of land that right now are eligible. Let me give you some examples. I already mentioned that people who are not farmers can qualify for the Green Acres program. Landowners can benefit from the program even when most of their land is not in agricultural production. A couple of examples here, land that's set aside in a conservation reserve program is eligible for Green Acres benefits. Also, parcels that are mostly wooded, but they happen to have 12 or 15 acres that are tilled, those too are eligible for the program. Land that have values that have increased due to recreational pursuits, like hunting, also qualify for the program. And another source of some controversy is the small farms, 10 or 12 or 15 acres. The question there is the difficulty in some cases of determining whether those parcels are simply large residential properties or whether they are indeed primarily devoted to agricultural use as required by law. Now, I'd want to point out, make it clear that all these cases, these examples I've given are legal. Right now, Minnesota statutes do allow them to be eligible for the program, but we think it's important for the legislature to review who ought to be eligible for the Green Acres program because, first of all, the benefits are sizable for an individual landowner. And secondly, the benefits that those enrollees receive are paid for by shifting the property tax burden onto the community residents who are not enrolled in the program. So for those reasons, we think it's worthwhile for the legislature to consider who really ought to be the beneficiaries for the program.
And Ms. Hauer, when you were talking about the goals of the program, did you go back and review the origin, you know, the origins of this bill and trying to analyze the purpose? From my view, the purpose of this program is to equalize the property taxes, to take away the non-ag impacts on the ag land values. from my perspective, it doesn't have anything to do with preserving open space or, you know, keeping land undeveloped. I mean, I that's from my perspective. But do you have any history that would be different than that?
Mr. Chair, I think how you characterized it is correct. As I said, the statutes do not say anything about preserving farmland, even though a lot of people have associated that with the program. And even if it is, even if it had been explicit, from our perspective, it's not effective at doing that. So, yes, it, truly, equalization is the explicit purpose stated in law for the program. And the law does not talk about preserving farmland, even though a lot of people think it is intended for that.
And Ms. Hauer, from what I'm understanding, what you're saying is, while it might be effective at equalizing the property taxes on these lands, it's very unclear if the people that are currently benefiting from the program fit the original intent of who should be benefiting from the program.
Well, Mr. Chair, we concluded that it's worthwhile for the legislature to relook at that. Just because there are these questionable cases, things that may not have been around at the time that the law was passed back in the late 60s, and we think because the benefits are substantial and because that the benefit is paid for by shifting the tax burden elsewhere, the legislature is it's appropriate for the legislature to relook at who should be benefiting from the program.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, we also concluded that there are problems with some of the eligibility criteria for the Green Acres program. Now, I mentioned earlier that there's a minimum income threshold that the owner has to have in order to qualify, and that income threshold has several problems. First of all, it was set back in 1969. It hasn't been aligned with land rents since then. Landowners who do apply for the program often balk at having to provide personal, what they consider to be personal financial information to the assessor. They don't feel comfortable in handing that over. And many of the farmers that do apply don't necessarily file the particular income tax form, the Schedule F, that assessors typically use to verify the income information that's on the application form. Plus, the assessors don't have access to income tax data. That's classified information. It's private information. It's not public. So they really don't have a good means for verifying information from all the applicants that come in. So as a result, the income criterion really doesn't sufficiently filter out those who might be ineligible.
Ms. Howard, to that point, though, these are people that are applying for a program, and it's not unreasonable to have requests of people to supply us with information when they apply. I mean, if they want to qualify for the Green Acres program, one of the conditions could be that you provide us with income data. Is that unreasonable?
Mr. Chair, I guess it could certainly be considered to be reasonable, especially when there is a considerable benefit attached to being enrolled in the program. The problem has come in how workable it is, and that's, I think, what some assessors have faced, where they just haven't been able to verify the incomes that have been listed on the application forms. And some, as I said, some owners simply resist handing over that kind of information. That's not to say there shouldn't be any eligibility criteria, and in a little bit I'll be talking about how we think that should change.
And did you look at all at the work that the legislature did last year with regard to this that was in some of our tax bills but didn't get passed into law?
Mr. Chair, yes. And again, I'll talk about that in just a minute.
Okay.
Because what we would like to recommend that the legislature do is reconsider those criteria, focus less on the income criterion, focus more on the criteria that will help determine how that land is actually used. Is it used for agricultural production? And so we would recommend focusing more on that side of things, less on the income criterion.
I will let you finish your presentation before we go on with this. I just kind of in my mind, I think back to 40 years ago when they were trying to do this, you know, initiate this program, and trying to come up with these tight definitions of agriculture is very hard. And I anticipate that the income was a compromise to do the eligibility that way. But I'll let you continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That does lead right into the one of the other problems that we saw with the eligibility criteria, and that has to do with how assessors classify the land as agricultural. Well, as you know, Minnesota statutes do, on classification of property, do define what types of things can qualify as agricultural, whether it's grains or livestock, bees and apiary products. But the statutes don't specify how much is sufficient to qualify for agricultural. So assessors face situations of not knowing whether there is a sufficient number of acres containing a sufficient number of beehives to qualify to receive that agricultural classification. And there's a similar problem with the statutory language regarding green acres land that has to be primarily devoted to agricultural use. Statutes don't define what is primarily devoted to agricultural use, and so interpreting that can be subjective. We found that implementing the Green Acres program has varied from county to county in the state, and that can result in unfairness. First, counties aren't uniform in whether they verify applicants' income. Second, there's variation in how assessors define land as primarily agricultural, as I was referring to a moment ago. Third, counties vary in how they treat parcels that have more than one owner. Fourth, in about half of the counties that have green acres land, assessors might classify one part of the parcel as residential, but then the remaining parts of that parcel they would classify as agricultural, a split classification. Now, in some of those counties, that land classified as agricultural could become eligible for green acres, but in other counties, that's not allowed. So, we have that discrepancy. And then finally, we saw differences in how assessors inform landowners about the program, make them aware of it. Now, many of the problems that I've been discussing here were apparent before we released our evaluation. As most of you know, the Department of Revenue did issue a bulletin in October of 2007 to help achieve statewide implementation of the Green Acres program. And in that bulletin, the department describes the difficulties that assessors have in setting that low agricultural use value for the green acres land, because the department believes that there are just so few farmland sales left that are made purely for agricultural purposes. So that limits what a county can do in terms of putting on that lower agricultural use value. And in the bulletin, the department does describe a method that it is intending to use to set that low agricultural use value in each county of the state. We think that that method works reasonably well for most counties in terms of their tillable land. But we think it's less useful for the non-tillable lands. And as the chair suggested at the outset of this presentation, there are quite a few acres in the Green Acres program that are non-tillable. About 38% of the acreage is non-tillable acreage. So essentially, the method that the department is proposing sets a single statewide percentage that will be applied to the non-tillable land in each of the counties. So the non-tillable land will be valued at about half of the agricultural value of the tillable land. Now, we don't think that's realistic, because we know that in some counties, particularly some in north-central Minnesota, the non-tillable acres can be very close to the agricultural value of the tillable acres. And so using that one single statewide percentage isn't as realistic as we'd like to see it. Now, the bulletin does also provide guidance to assessors in implementing the program, and that guidance is intended to improve on the consistency from county to county, which we think is a good thing. We think that guidance is valuable. We do point out in the report a few additional subjects where we think more guidance might be helpful. Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to talk about the recommendations now for the Green Acres program. We recommend that the legislature, first of all, clarify in statute who and what types of land should be eligible to benefit from the Green Acres program. Second, we think that the legislature should change the law by eliminating the criterion for the minimum income threshold at the same time that it would add specificity to the statutes for classifying properties agricultural and also for defining land that is primarily agricultural in use. Now, as I was saying earlier in response to the chair's question, I think that this approach would help focus the program more on how the land is used and less on who the owner happens to be. You know, in last year's tax bill, there was some language that would have made the income threshold a certain percentage of the total family income, and that would help in some situations by eliminating some landowners who are not farmers today. But it could also have a negative impact. It could also make ineligible those who do truly farm the land, happen to have a spouse who has a second job, and then that group of farmers and farm families would also be eliminated. And so we thought that there might be a different approach to take. In addition, we recommend that the Department of Revenue continue the efforts it started to make the program more consistent and to make it implement it statewide. But we do recommend modifying its approach, especially in how it would value those non-tillable acres enrolled in the program. Mr. Chair, I would go on to a couple of final slides about the Farmland Preservation Programs, and then I'll conclude. As I mentioned at the start, Minnesota has two programs specifically set up to preserve farmland. One is for the seven counties in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. The second is designed for counties in greater Minnesota. Now, the benefits of the two programs are quite similar, but there are some important differences. Land that's enrolled in the Metropolitan Agricultural Preserves Program enjoys the tax advantage of that low taxable value, similar to what is used in the Green Acres Program. However, this is not available for the land enrolled in that Greater Minnesota Farmland Preservation Program. In both programs, the participants receive what's the equivalent of $1.50 per acre tax credit each year. Public improvements like
Ms. Howard, would you tell the committee where that dollar and a half comes from? There's a deed tax or something that funds that?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. And I do have a slide on that, too, but just in brief, the $1.50 tax credit is paid for by a $5 fee that is charged in those counties that participate in the program every time someone registers or records a deed or a mortgage. And I'm going to give you a little bit more detail in just a moment on that.
Okay, I'll wait.
So the public improvements that, like water and sewer, they're not allowed within an agricultural preserve, and so the landowners there do not pay any special assessments, which, of course, can be a considerable break.
And, Ms. Howard, to the special assessment, what about watershed districts' assessments? Because, you know, watershed districts are doing the drainage in many situations or the water management for all the land. Do they pay any of those either?
Mr. Chair, if it's done via a special assessment, even a drainage system is not assessed against the property within an agricultural preserve.
Okay. How about the Green Acres special assessments? I know we had discussion about this last year. Would Green Acres, which is farmland, which drainage would be important, would they pay watershed special assessments?
Mr. Chair, for the Green Acres program, the special assessments are deferred until that land is no longer in agricultural production, until the owner would sell the land, for instance.
Thank you.
And then also other two other benefits associated with the farmland preservation programs is that towns and cities may not pass any ordinances that unreasonably restrict farming operations or unreasonably manage farm structures. And then finally, cities may not annex land that's in an agricultural preserve within a township unless it meets very certain specific conditions. Now, we found that the farmland preservation programs, as I said at the outset, can help shape development, can help stage the pace of the development in an area. And the reason it can do that is that land enrolled has to have a restrictive covenant on the deed. That covenant requires the landowner to keep the land in agricultural use for a minimum of 8 years. Now, many of the local officials that we talked to as a part of our evaluation saw the farmland preservation programs as a useful tool. They thought that it helped them preserve the land in their area, helped them reinforce their own local land use policies. They would talk about benefits such as preventing the kind of scattered development that might occur when somebody would build near to a farm and then later create land use conflicts because that new resident objected to the smell or the noise or the dust or the dirt of the farming operations. But these kind of programs can help prevent that from occurring. Now, at the same time, though, we concluded the programs are not fully effective at preserving farmland over the long term. And that's for a number of reasons that I'll talk about right now. First are simply the economic forces and the market conditions that are out there. Farmland has become extremely valuable around the state. Again, the earlier speakers alluded to that. The benefits of the program, although they can be considerable, they're small when you compare them to the financial gain of selling the land. I want to give you just an example. Over the last 10 years, in the Twin Cities area, the estimated market value for an acre of farmland increased $8,100 in the Twin Cities area, increased $1,400 in greater Minnesota. And those are just the averages. When you have those kind of high increases in the land values on a per-acre basis, they can outweigh whatever incentive the program brings for keeping that land in agricultural uses. Now, another factor that limits the effectiveness of the programs is low and declining enrollment. And this table on the chart on this slide shows that. Of the 9 participating counties in these farmland preservation programs, only one, Carver County, has more than half of its farmland acres enrolled in the program. All 9 of the counties have had enrollment declines since 1998, when enrollment peaked. One example I'll point out, Scott County, only 6% of its farmland acres are now enrolled in the Metropolitan Agricultural Preserves Program. And since the late 1990s, it lost 15% of the farmland acres that were enrolled. For the greater Minnesota counties, the low number of governments participating is also a factor that limits its effectiveness. There have been only three counties that have ever had land enrolled in the Greater Minnesota Program. That's Waseca, Winona, and Wright counties. And of those three, only one has a third of its farmland acres enrolled as of last year. The other two are far smaller percentages. And finally, we think that the program's effectiveness is limited because it's relatively easy for a participant to leave the program. And once they do meet that 8-year requirement, they can terminate their covenant, and they do so without a penalty. Beyond the questions on effectiveness, we also found that there's no one at either the state or the local government level who has enforcement authority over the farmland preservation programs. The law contains no sanction for noncompliance, and we did find in our evaluation a small number of cases, just a handful, where the land in the agricultural preserve did get developed prior to that 8-year term ending or before the owner actually filed notice for a termination of the preserve. My last slide, Mr. Chair, talks about the fee that you brought up just a moment ago. We looked at the revenues that are raised through these preservation programs. As I said, the participating counties can charge $5 for every mortgage or deed recorded in the county, and the county share of that money is put into a county conservation account. The counties use that money then to reimburse the local governments who have to pay for that $1.50 per acre tax credit I mentioned earlier going to the participants in the farmland preservation programs. Then any money left over after they reimburse that $1.50 per acre tax credit can be used by the counties for certain purposes that are specified in law. And those purposes include farmland preservation, conservation planning, and also soil conservation. Now, we looked then at how the counties have spent those excess revenues over the last 5 years. We found that most of the dollars are used to help fund the soil and water conservation districts. And those districts do use the money on soil conservation and to prevent erosion, well within what the law allows. We did see, though, a small number of projects that were, in our opinion, only very loosely tied to what the law allows. One example, master gardener programs. Although they're worthwhile by themselves, one could question whether they actually meet what the law says the revenues ought to be spent on. But those very few projects that were what we called loosely tied to the law were approved locally because the language in the law can be interpreted very broadly. So that leads me to the recommendations. Based on our findings, Mr. Chair and members, we think that if Minnesota does wish to preserve lands for agricultural use over the long term, that the legislature should consider supplementing the existing programs with other approaches. I mean, there are land acquisition programs. There are development transfer programs. We mentioned some of the alternatives in our report, but I also have to say that none of them comes cheaply. All of them bear fairly large costs. We think that the legislature should improve the existing programs by specifying in law who does have authority to enforce them and by also setting some penalties for noncompliance. And then finally, we recommend that the legislature determine whether spending those $5 fee revenues on projects other than farmland preservation or other than soil conservation is unacceptable. And if it is unacceptable, then the legislature will have to change the statutory language to specify what activities are unallowable. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I conclude my remarks. I'll be glad to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hauer. And the sign-up for the counties is to implement the $5 fee on the deed. And did you at all think about the possibility of making this a statewide, state-funded program? Did anybody ever, so that counties would just be in it and all counties would do the $5 fee and so the county boards didn't have to proactively do that?
Mr. Chair, that was an option that was discussed back in 1999, I think, when the Department of Agriculture had an evaluation conducted of the farmland preservation programs. The thing is that the program requires the county or the municipality to put together a farmland preservation plan. It requires local controls that would keep the land in agricultural use. Now, that authority for land use planning has in Minnesota always been traditionally at the local government level. The state has had some influence, obviously, but the local governments have decided whether or not they, you know, the extent to which they want to control how land is used. And so I think that that history of how land use controls have been implemented around the state probably would greatly affect any change that would make this program mandatory for all counties or all municipalities in the state. It would be just sort of a 180-degree turn from the way things have been done in the past.
And the other thing I think I read in your report, and you didn't mention it, was that the benefits to the Ag Preserve program were very comparable to Green Acres. And so a lot of people just sign up for Green Acres, and the Ag Preserve program doesn't get utilized. But if we strengthen or change Green Acres so that a sizable percentage of current people taking advantage it might not qualify, do you think that would have an effect on the people that would be utilizing the Ag Land Preservation programs?
Mr. Chair, it could. Remember, though, that the participants in the Ag Land Preservation programs do have a covenant, a restrictive covenant on their deed, which does require them for at least 8 years to keep the land in agricultural production. That might, for some people, be enough of a disincentive to not apply. But I think you're right that anything, because both of these programs, the Green Acres Program and the Farmland Preservation Programs, obviously are both aimed at agricultural land. So to the extent that one program is changed, it certainly will have an effect on the other program. Remember, though, that the as of today, all except Ramsey County in the metropolitan area, all six of the remaining metropolitan area counties do have agricultural preserves, although the enrollment has been declining. People have shown less interested in participating in that program. And then, of course, in greater Minnesota, we've only got the three counties that have ever gotten to the point of having the program implemented within their boundaries.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Mr. Folkman, were you going to come up and give us a little response from the department to some of this?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Gordon Folkman, Director of the Property Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. And just a few comments. I just want to support the Office of Legislative Auditor and the report that they did. We reviewed it, and we had also our working group with the assessors review the report. And we find that we find that their findings and their recommendations are something we can fully support. The other thing I'd like to be able to do with you is just to maybe highlight some of the issue or one particular recommendation that the Office of Legislative Auditor did recommend. And that was the necessity and the importance of the legislature to really try and address the clarification of the Green Acres law, most specifically in terms of that question of who or what should qualify for Green Acres program. We feel that it's important for the legislature to address that overriding policy and legislative intent, because it's with that direction we can better administer and come up with specific guidelines to administer the law and work with the assessors for more uniformity in its applications. So I think that's extremely important to follow up on the OLA report to look at that clarification issue. In addition, I'd also like to bring the committee up to speed with respect to what the department has been doing over the last year, working with the assessors. Jody Hauer mentioned the fact that we did a Green Acres Bulletin. We issued that in October of last year. And the bulletin was a follow-up to the initial report we did on Green Acres that was mandated by the legislature, and we presented that in 2006. The Green Acres Bulletin that we issued was a product of the department forming a working group with the assessors. And the purpose of that bulletin was to try and look at the current law and its provisions and try and take a best stab at to what we think the intent or different types of guidelines and recommendations we could put forward that would be represent a more uniform application of what we think current law says. We did, in putting together the bulletin, we purposely put a 2009, or assessment year 2009 effective date in place. And the purpose for that was twofold. One, we want, because of the discovery that there were significant disparities or just differences in practices throughout the counties and different interpretations of what ag definition should apply under what conditions and where Green Acres was being applied and where it wasn't. We felt that we needed to put together a set of directives that we could then share with the assessors generally throughout the state and get some reaction to them as in terms of the adequacy of those provisions. But equally important, we also wanted to have the opportunity to share those recommendations with the legislature. So the 2009 assessment year effective date allows for the counties to weigh in terms of what they would seem as to be a reasonable approach to the current law, but also has an opportunity for the legislature to take a look at those recommendations and to come to some agreement or some comfort level as to what current law would require. If I think members, do they have copies of the bulletin in your packet?
Yes, I believe they do, Mr. Okay. Copeland.
One thing I just want to summarize for you from the bulletin, I think it's on page 4 of the bulletin, we identified 6 areas which we think specifically needs to be addressed in terms of some policy direction. Ms. Hauer indicated or pointed out the Green Acre methodology, which I think is extremely important because it is sort of a trigger mechanism to determine when a county should be thinking about eligibility for the Green Acres program. And her reference to the fact that there is some general agreement about the methodology with respect to tillable land. I think the assessors are recognizing that too. But there are questions with respect to that non-tillable value. And the fundamental problem we have there is that trying to come up with, under current law, the law requires us to come up with a valuation based on our use basis. And it's very difficult to come up with an agricultural value on property that's not tillable or not used for agricultural purposes. And so whenever you're trying to come up with this artificial value, it creates some issues and problems for the assessors. The second, just run through real quickly some of the other issues, was the split classification. I think Ms. Hauer referenced that, too, as to what extent you should have a split class between residential and agricultural properties. Parcels less than 10 acres, if we have difficulty trying to interpret what exclusively and intensively means. Primarily devoted to agriculture, has some wide variations throughout the counties as well. Green Acres income thresholds, which was part of the things that were in the Senate bill last year, and the legislative auditor's office raised that, and the county assessors have indicated some of the administrative issues associated with doing those kinds of criteria. And last but not least, the payback provisions, which ultimately gets tied back to that other policy issue of, is the program really meant for preservation or just simply equalizing tax burdens? As a give you a little bit more information as to where we're at now, we have worked with our Green Acres Working Group, which has several assessors on it. We've also now touched base with the ag community. And we're having a meeting next Monday with them to get their input, their perspective of what is an ag activity. Ms. Hauer also indicated some of the difficulties trying to come grips with what is an agricultural product, what is an agricultural use, and what isn't. More importantly, how much of that do you need to really be considered a farmer in a farming activity? But I think we need to have some agricultural perspective on that as well. The markets and the industry has changed significantly in terms of what we might consider to be adequate agricultural use. We've also tried to touch base with the Association of Minnesota Counties because they've had some significant political interest in it as well. Last month, I've also talked a little bit with Representative Marquardt over on the House side, and I've suggested that maybe as we move forward in this session, sort of have a sidebar working group with the some members from the House and the Senate working with our Green Acres Working Group to explore some of the issues that the Legislative Auditor Office has raised and the issues we're raising with this bulletin. And Representative Marquardt has designated, and Representative Dimmer and Representative Conan from their Property Tax Committee has agreed to participate on this. And so with that, it would be nice to be able to have someone from the Senate, too, to work on their group to work on these issues and then probably try and get some direction and get some legislation before the tax committee, before the session ends. Well, so that's where we're at now.
Well, Mr. Folkman, I think we will do that, and we will get a couple members to be part of that group or to certainly have continued discussions. I do have some thoughts that I want to share with you and to the assessors and the members of that group. I think that the by 2009, this is going to be implemented statewide. It is very important that we fix this. And we now have 35 counties, I think I heard, that do not have this implemented at all. So we really do need to get what program we're going to have in place by then, so when those counties do the implementation, it's done as we intend. And I think it's important that we focus this program on who and what acres were originally designed to be benefited from this. And to that point, I think it should be targeted at tillable, and perhaps tillable and pasture, but my thoughts are not to the 38% that are currently enrolled that's non-tillable. There's a number of problems with the getting the values, but it also, it clearly is not agriculture land and probably shouldn't be benefiting from this program. So I think that we really need to focus in on that. I do think that one thing that we should think about, and certainly your group should consider, and I know there's difficulties with the income provisions here, but perhaps at the very least we could ask the applicant to demonstrate a Schedule F, whether we see the numbers on it or not, to at least know that they have some ag income. And so that would be something to think about. The other thing, I think, when we think about these three programs, the ag preserve, two ag preserve programs and Green Acres, is do we really need three programs? And perhaps we should eliminate Green Acres altogether and just fix up one of the other preserve programs. And I think as we move forward this session, that should be part of our discussion. I'd certainly like to hear reactions back from the group that is working on this, the department and the assessors. And so that's kind of where I'm at on that. Members, do you have any questions? And the one thing I want to point out to the members in the legislative auditor's report, and Senator Ortman, this should be of some particular interest to you, I believe. On page 24, there's a graph or a table in here that shows counties, and it shows the counties by tax increase on all the rest of the residential homestead properties just for the sheltering of the Green Acres. And some of these counties are up to 20%. So that's a significant issue, I would think, in those counties. And so, you know, if we're going to have that type of tax increase on everybody else in the county to on these ag lands, I think it behooves us to make sure we're making this program targeted to where it should be and benefiting who we want it to benefit. And so does any member have comments?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I would say that this is not a surprise to anybody in Carver County, and certainly not to the county board or to the taxpayers. I mean, I think they're very well aware of that, and I think it's actually a credit that when we put this program together, it was designed to do something, and it's actually working in Carver County. There is definitely some tension and conflict about whether we should continue, and I think that's immediately of interest to the county board. I think they're working on that now, but whether they want to continue with this program. But these studies do help to at least lay the whole foundation, show the whole framework of what's happening across the state, and they're very helpful. So thank you.
Anything else? Okay, thank you. We were to be done by 10:30. I think we made it. We'll look forward to working with the department and the legislative auditor as we move forward on this. Property Tax Division is adjourned.